Ceasefire negotiations continue as Secretary Blinken presses for a deal.
It is on Hamas to move forward with this proposal or not. And it's very clear what, as I said, virtually the entire international community wants to see.
Plus, the plane carrying the vice president of Malawi has been found.
And they have found it completely destroyed with no survivors, as all passengers on board were killed on impact.
And later, the foreign policies of Donald Trump and Joe Biden. A controversial battalion in Ukraine is given access to American weapons and the freedom of the press in the U.S. and in Russia. Today is Tuesday, June 11th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The foreign policies of Biden and Trump, coming up in a moment. But first, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Tuesday that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has reaffirmed his commitment to a proposed multi-stage ceasefire. Blinken said the U.N. Security Council's approval of a U.S.-drafted resolution made it clear that a ceasefire deal is what the world is looking for.
So, everyone's vote is in, except for one vote, and that's Hamas. And that's what we wait for. It is on Hamas to move forward with this proposal or not. And it's very clear what, as I said, virtually the entire international community wants to see, and of course what so many families want to see. And it's also what the people of Gaza so desperately need.
Blinken said a Hamas statement of support for the UN resolution backing the ceasefire was a hopeful sign. Also on Tuesday, at a conference on the humanitarian response for Gaza in Jordan, Secretary Blinken announced that the U.S. would be giving more humanitarian aid to Palestinians.
Today, I'm announcing an additional $404 million in new aid to Palestinians, in addition to the more than $1.8 billion in development, economic, and humanitarian aid that the United States has provided since 2021. Second, let's work together to ensure that more aid gets into Gaza and, once it's in Gaza, reaches the people who need it the most, by land, by air, by sea.
Blinken said that Israel has taken some important steps to address obstacles to the delivery of assistance in Gaza, but that it can and must do more. He also called on Israel to take further steps to reduce civilian casualties. Meanwhile, Jeremy Lawrence, the spokesperson for the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, said on Tuesday that the killings of civilians in Gaza during the Israeli hostage rescue operation this past weekend could amount to war crimes. At the same time, Lawrence said that the holding of hostages in such densely populated areas by Hamas could also amount to a war crime. The wars in the Middle East and Europe, along with the U.S. rivalry with China, will remain key issues to U.S. diplomats no matter who wins the American presidential election in November. But depending on who wins, the lives of people around the world could be drastically different. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara looks at the foreign policy priorities of the two candidates, Joe Biden and Donald Trump.
Picture the year 2025. A permanent ceasefire in Gaza could still be out of reach. A war of attrition still simmering in Ukraine, and China continues to be a threat. Whether Joe Biden or Donald Trump wins the presidency, these challenges will remain. Biden's second-term foreign policy will be based on the same principles as his first: global leadership and multilateralism.
The United States will compete and will compete vigorously and lead with our values and our strength. We'll stand up for our allies and our friends.
Plus, a focus on an area the administration believes it needs to improve on. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
It's a major initiative with the Congress aimed at truly delivering on the promise of unlocking resources for the developing world.
Development bank reforms and various infrastructure projects worldwide. The goal, to push back on China's global development initiatives by supporting various corridor projects around the world, such as the Lobito Corridor that connects Zambia, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Angola. Again, Jake Sullivan.
We can not only build out a transportation capacity to help ensure that we have the inputs for our clean energy supply chains, but also unlock Africa's vast agricultural potential by getting goods to market, and also unlock a digital transformation across that area.
If Trump wins, there won't be as much focus on international development.
Make America richer and safer and stronger and prouder and more beautiful than ever before. I think we have a final shot at it.
Although Trump's catchphrase is America first, it does not mean his foreign policy is isolationist, said Rachel Rizzo, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council.
Mercantilist, sure. Transactionalist, yes. But I think the most interesting part of his foreign policy is just the degree to which his vision of the tools of U.S. power be used in a different way.
Unwavering support for Israel, conditional aid to Ukraine, and a strong rivalry with China. These are foreign policy principles proposed for a second term by the Trump-affiliated think tank America First Policy Institute. Chad Wolf is the Institute's executive director.
Those are three areas that any incoming America First administration is going to have to deal with. And it's going to have to put that peace through strength test, right? That approach to the test.
While we don't know who will win in November, we do know that foreign policy won't be the determining factor. Polls suggest most Americans are more concerned with inflation, the economy, immigration and crime than with U.S. engagements abroad. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
A two-day Ukraine recovery conference began in Berlin with President Zelensky, Olaf Scholz, and Ursula von der Leyen in attendance. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has lifted the ban on the supply of weapons to the so-called Azov Brigade. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
On Tuesday, President Volodymyr Zelensky took part in the Ukraine recovery conference in Berlin. He also met with German Federal President Frank-Walter Steinmeier to discuss the security situation and military operations along the front line. Two leaders also discussed the partnership between Ukrainian and German cities and communities. Zelensky held talks with Chancellor Olaf Scholz, with whom he mainly talked about the situation on the battlefield, strengthening of the Ukrainian air defense, and ensuring Ukraine's sufficient energy generation for the coming years. According to the Ukrainian authorities, as of May 2024, damages and losses in the energy sector of Ukraine due to the Russian full-scale invasion reached $56.2 billion. Zelensky and Scholz also discussed Ukraine's European integration. The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, during her speech at the conference, confirmed that Ukraine has completed all the necessary steps to start negotiations on joining the EU by the end of this month. Zelensky said that Germany is a leader in helping Ukraine to protect the skies with Patriot systems and announced a new air defense arrangement, another Patriot system, and more. Also, the president of Ukraine is to make a personal appearance in the German Bundestag for the first time and visit a military base where Ukrainian soldiers are undergoing training. Meanwhile, the Biden administration lifted the ban on supplying weapons to the so-called Azov Brigade of the National Guard of Ukraine. They were denied weapons because about a decade ago, American officials decided that some of its founders allegedly held racist, xenophobic, and ultranationalist views, and UN human rights officials accused the group of violating humanitarian law. The State Department said that after thorough research, the Azov Brigade passed an inspection that found no evidence of human rights violations by Azov. Now, the Azov Brigade, a once volunteer unit that became part of the National Guard of Ukraine in 2015, will have access to the same military assistance from the U.S. as any other unit. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Malawian Vice President Saulus Chilimea and nine other people died when the small military plane they were traveling in crashed in bad weather in a mountainous region in the north of the country, the president said Tuesday.
The search and rescue team, in the Chikangawa Forest, and they have found it completely destroyed with no survivors, as all passengers on board were killed on impact. Words cannot describe how heartbreaking this is, and I can only imagine how much pain and anguish you all must be feeling at this time.
President Lazarus Chakwera made the announcement in a live address on state television. Residents of Blantyre reacted to the news. That's Sibongai Rober. He said that Chilumea was a youthful leader there to guide and direct the country, and that all Malawian youth are saddened by his death. Chilumea was 51. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll examine the freedom of the press and how journalists are treated in the United States as well as in Russia in a moment. First, though, the northern New England state of Vermont has a unique, if untested, approach to helping pay for the effects of climate change. The state recently passed a law that would require polluters that burn fossil fuels to pay into a state fund that would be used to help pay the bills. For more, I'm joined by Vermont State Senator Ann Cummings.
In short, it seeks to require that the big oil industry help pay to clean up the mess it has caused with global warming.
So essentially what you're asking that is for the people who've made the mess to clean it up or to pay to have it cleaned up.
Yes.
But how does that work with climate change? Because climate pollution that took place in maybe New York State or even Canada could affect the environment in Vermont. How are you penalizing people across state lines? How does that work?
The bill charges the Natural Resources Department to come up with a methodology for assessing that. It does not set the methodology.
Interesting. So you're asking folks to pay for damages without really asserting how those damages are going to be levied. How does this work? Is, I think, a fair question.
It is. And this is new. We are the first person, you know, first state to do this. So we are working our way through it. There's myriads of information on how much carbon gets put up and, you know, how much impact there has been. There's documentation from the industry as to when they knew that they were contributing. And we have charged the natural resources people and given them some resources to work with scientists to develop a formula, to say. So this is not, nobody's getting a bill next week from the state of Vermont. This is a work in progress.
Is this something that would work better, perhaps, on the national level than one state?
It probably would, because, as you said, this is an international problem. I think Vermont suffered catastrophic floods last summer. It's costing a great deal of public dollars to clean up. There's been a major, economic impact. The people of Vermont didn't cause the mess in large part.
Now, last question, Senator. One of the best things about Vermont is a cold winter day and a roaring fire in the fireplace. You're not going to make me pay extra for that smoke coming out the chimney, are you?
Not at this point, we aren't. We do offer you a subsidy for an advanced wood heat boiler, though.
Senator Ann Cummings is a state senator from Vermont, and she's a member of the General Assembly representing Washington County. Senator Cummings, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
And now, press freedom. Since the start of Russia's large-scale invasion of Ukraine, the Kremlin has carried out a campaign of repression against local and foreign journalists, including via intimidation, threats, expulsions, and arrests. Ricardo Marquina has the story, narrated for us today by Marcus Harton.
After 12 years as a correspondent for the Spanish newspaper El Mundo in Russia, Javier Colas is back in Madrid, but not for pleasure. As of early June, Javier is the latest foreign correspondent to be expelled by the Russian government.
Hemos estado bajo sanciones, es decir, nosotros hemos tenido...
He says foreign journalists have been under sanctions. We have had 3-month visas instead of 1-year visas as we had before. I was on a blacklist of people whose visa was not renewed and who could not remain in the Russian Federation any longer. Moscow claims these are not expulsions. In the case of Javier Colas, as they did with others, Russian officials blamed the visa denials on journalists who, they say, made errors on their applications. But in a Russia at war, there is no place for free journalism, only for the propaganda of what the Kremlin calls its special military operation in Ukraine. For many foreign journalists, the pressure is greater due to Russia's foreign agents law. Analysts say the Kremlin uses the law to target critics, with some at risk of jail. American-Russian journalist Alsu Kermashava has been in custody for 8 months for failing to self-register. The Prague-based journalist for VOA sister network Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, denies wrongdoing. Kermasheva is one of two American journalists Russia is detaining. Evan Gershkovich, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, was arrested in March 2023. Russian authorities accuse him of espionage, something his family, friends, and colleagues say is simply false. One of his colleagues at the Wall Street Journal, senior reporter Drew Henshaw, spoke to VOA.
The arrest of Evan and the expulsion of other foreign journalists has been the capstone point of a decades-long process of intimidation of Russian journalists. This is something that Russian journalists have lived with for quite literally the entirety of Putin's time in power.
Foreign journalists in Russia are becoming fewer and fewer, and independent Russian journalists have only two options: work underground at great risk, or go into exile, a dark landscape that shows no signs of changing in the near future. For Ricardo Marquina, Marcus Harton, VOA News.
And in the United States, the freedom of the press is guaranteed by the Constitution's First Amendment, yet conflicts between journalists and police persist. Robin Guest has more.
As police across the United States shut down protests over the Israel-Hamas war, journalists say they are also being targeted.
You're filming this, right, Genevieve?
Yep. Yes.
Here, four officers detain and handcuff columnist Robin Epley of California's Sacramento Bee, covering protesters during a recent city council meeting.
This one in particular, though, is so egregious because the people who were doing this to me are the people who are supposed to keep us safe. The police department is supposed to uphold the law. And in reality, what they were doing was breaking it.
Sacramento police, in an email, blamed Epley for not wearing a newly created city press credential. But Epley and others say police violated a 2021 California law that specifically protects journalists covering protests. Conflicts between police and journalists during George Floyd protests led to police policy changes in Minnesota, Los Angeles, New York, and elsewhere. But the problem persists, according to the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. The group's data show police arrested or detained 36 journalists covering Israel-Hamas demonstrations since October. Here's journalist John Farina with online news organization Status Quo.
What is at stake here is our constitutional rights, our human rights. You know, the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of the press. There is no regard for that from law enforcement.
Farina shot this video of a journalist knocked down and then arrested by New York police. She's covering the May protests at Columbia University. He's captured other instances of New York police assaulting reporters. The New York Police Department hasn't responded to VOA's emailed and phone requests for comment. NYPD recently paid $10 million to settle a 2021 lawsuit brought by journalists and protesters who say police assaulted and arrested them without cause during 2020's George Floyd social justice protests. This is Mickey Ostreicher, the general counsel for the National Press Photographers Association.
It was not only a monetary settlement, but we sought equitable relief. We wanted the police to do things and change their policies and change their training regarding how at least journalists were treated.
These police and press conflicts during protests aren't unique to the U.S. UNESCO finds that covering protests anywhere in the world is one of a journalist's most dangerous assignments. The UN adds, police forces are a critical part of that danger journalists face. Robin Guess, VOA News.
In the capital of Sudan's North Darfur state, displaced people and doctors say the paramilitary rapid support forces are attacking hospitals and camps. Meanwhile, nonprofits say the world is paying little attention as a city that was supposed to be a haven for those forced out of their homes by Sudan's war is being torn apart. Henry Wilkins has that story.
El Fasher, the capital city of North Darfur State, was supposed to be safe. About 800,000 people displaced by fighting and alleged ethnic cleansing in the surrounding Darfur countryside have fled here hoping to find refuge. But since mid-April, El Fasher too has become a war zone. Refugee camps have been caught in the crossfire and even shelled as the Sudanese military battles the paramilitary rapid support forces for control of the city. More than 1,200 have been killed, says Doctors Without Borders. From inside El Fasher, Adam Rojal, a spokesperson for a local non-profit helping Darfur's displaced, told VOA that people here don't care about the warring sides. They just want the fighting to stop. He says the military and the RSF are not patriots and are fighting only in their own interests, adding that the only loser is Sudanese society, especially people in Darfur. He says people have lost everything, even basic needs to live, like food, water, shelter, and medicine. He says words can't describe how serious the situation is. Claire Nicolette works with the non-profit Doctors Without Borders, which operates medical facilities in El Fasher. She said one of its maternity wards was shelled, as well as the main surgical hospital.
The roof fall down on babies that were inside the hospital, and we had to close down after the death of these two children. Surgical hospital, I can say, which is receiving all the wounded at the moment, has been touched four times now in 10 days.
She says the situation is only getting worse and that the violence is indiscriminate.
We hear about drones now, we hear about snipers. So we just see that the situation is just deteriorating over and over. It's kind of full war inside the city. So unfortunately, there is no protection of civilians, no protection of health structures whatsoever. That's the reality.
Rojal says the fighting has prevented people from leaving the city and aid groups from delivering food to the starving within its borders. He says families are living in dire conditions, himself included, because they're not getting aid from the UN's World Food Programme. Nonprofits have complained about the unusually low donations for the Sudan crisis, in part because of the Ukraine and Gaza wars, while human rights groups have criticised the UN and African Union for not doing enough. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Carey.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.